It's actually a really good fit in the sense that I'm here following Norman's presentation, because there's a lot of similarity between what I'm going to talk about and what Norman presented at the beginning. I'm going to do it for the U.S. instead of for Canada, and then we have a couple slight differences. First off, again, I have no relationships to disclose. I first want to acknowledge the project that this came from, funded by NIAAA. My investigation team there, as well as the staff. Again, it's a team effort, and I'm just here talking today. But I represent all these great people. So like I said, the general approach that we had for this project was that we wanted to be able to come up with some kind of a score of the alcohol policy environment for each of the 50 states in the U.S., and then we wanted to see if that's in fact related to some outcomes. So that was the kind of goal of the big project. And so what I'm going to focus on today is that process we went through to come up with that score for each state. Again, very similar to what Norman did in Canada, but you're going to see the process is somewhat different. And then I'm going to correlate that with some alcohol use outcomes. So when you start trying to do that, trying to combine policies and put them together into an index or a score, you realize there's a lot of problems that get in the way. The first one you have to deal with, again, is that not all policies are created equal, and so we can't necessarily be combining them and saying that policy A, which may have a very strong reach and deterrent effect, is going to be the equivalent to policy B, which might be a much weaker policy. So we have to somehow figure out how to do that, and you saw Norman and his team came up with an effectiveness rating and all that, and they used that to be able to do that, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we did. Second, some policies have some kind of a natural metric, right? You can think of taxes or a minimum drinking age. They have some kind of a natural metric, but a lot of policies don't. And so if we want to move beyond just saying you have this policy or you don't, we have to try and figure out what that metric is. We have to get at that strength score. And then how do we do that? How are we going to actually do that? We could use components, look at all the different components that go into a policy and figure out which ones really matter, and then kind of add those up. Expert opinion, which is again what Norman did. A lot of different options you can do this. And then again, when we start combining them, how are we going to combine them? Standardize them and combine them, et cetera. Should be weighted, all that stuff. So these were all of the kind of complicating factors that we had to try to figure out how to do. Now, I will say that there were a couple differences. First off, we have, Norman talked about, they had to go around and figure out for every province what are all these policies in every province, and they had to get the data and do all that. We don't have to do that here in the U.S., and we don't have to do that here in the U.S. because we have the APA system. And I'm sure most everybody in this room is familiar with the APA system. It's an invaluable resource. This project could not have been done without APAs, because all that legal research for all the 50 states, going back in some cases to 1998, is just sitting there waiting for us to go in there and start pulling it in. So that's a great asset. So what we did first is we said, let's try to develop a strength measure for a whole bunch of policies across the 50 states. And so let's come up with a protocol to do that. And so first I want to walk you through that protocol. Then I'm going to show you an example, just one example, one policy, so you get a sense of what's going on. Then I'm going to walk you through how we then combined all the ones once we had created the strength score for every state. And then finally we'll correlate it. Okay, so that's the gist of today's talk. So we had this multi-step process we developed. First off, we really need to understand each policy. Now, luckily, again, there's a lot of research out there. We've been doing this for a while. But you really have to get in, conceptually understand what each policy is about, get into the legal language. We have to have a legal researcher on our staff to help kind of discern the legal language. Again, APIS is there. It's a great resource for a lot of that. We had to come up with that coding protocol. So we had to figure out what makes a stronger policy than a weaker policy. And we had to figure that out. So again, we had a team of experts, and we developed this protocol. And the main three issues were reach, enforceability, and deterrence. So those are things that we factored into what's going to separate a strong policy from a weak policy. And then we had to actually go through and do all that coding part. And this is where we went to APIS. We pulled out all the data that's in there. APIS pulls in all the different components. And then we had to take all that and combine it and figure out what's going on. And so let's say that we got into a state, we got into a policy, and we could find that there were maybe three or four conceptual levels that we felt like there was a low strength, a medium high, and a high strength policy. Sometimes there'd be only one state in one of those categories. And so then, because we wanted to try and correlate this, we'd sometimes pare that down. So that's what I mean when I say distribution. So the example that I'm going to talk about today is Kegrang. So this is a snapshot of what the APIS system looks like, showing Kegrang. And I know you can't read that, but what I really want you to show is that they, for every state, for a given point in time, we did it for January 1, 2009, they will go through and identify all the different moving parts that go into that policy. Some policies have two, three, four. Kegrang is a pretty big one. It has, you know, a dozen different components to it. So they've already identified all them and created this great data set that we can then use. So we took all those different things and said, what's available to us around Kegrang? Let's understand the policy first, figure out which of those components do we think are most important to identifying a strong policy or a weak policy, and which ones maybe aren't that important, and we can try to trim down some of the data. So again, understand the policy. What's Kegrang about? You put an ID on a keg. You write down the name and address of the person who's buying that keg. If there's a party and the police come and there's a keg sitting there and it has that label on it, they can go back to the retailer and find out who purchased that keg. So, and sometimes there people put a required to put a big deposit down on that keg, and in some states it's illegal to tamper with that label, right? So the first thing a resourceful 21-year-old is going to do, right, is they're going to rip that label off, or they're going to marker over it or something. And so again, if a state makes it illegal or has some penalty for tampering with it, less incentive to do that. That's kind of the quick and dirty. What is Kegrang about? How is it going to function? Our main considerations for the effectiveness of Kegrang was enforceability and deterrence. How well is the law structured so that the police or law enforcement can actually use that as a resource? And so those were our primary drivers. So quickly, we came up with five levels of Kegrang policies, going from a weaker to a stronger. The least restrictive, 19 states in the U.S., January 1, 2009, had no keg registration policy at all. So it was easy. We just put them in. That's going to be the least restrictive if you don't have the policy. Second, our friends here in Utah, they do not allow keg sales of any kind in the state of Utah. So that's clearly. So we did this for almost all the policies we looked at. We kind of bookended the two, and then we had to kind of work through the middle. Because that middle part is where it gets complicated, right? Does it really matter if this state has all the same components but they require deposit? Is that stronger than another state that has all those but doesn't require deposit? So that's where we had to start getting into it and got a little bit more complicated. We identified what we called core components to a Kegrang law. Again, this was talking to our experts, thinking about how is Kegrang going to function. We felt like at a minimum, for a Kegrang policy to work, you had to record the name and address and get the ID of the person who's purchasing it. Some policies don't require that. If you don't require that, there's no teeth to that. Second, like I mentioned, you have to have it somehow prohibited that you're going to tamper with or destroy that label to, again, take the feet out from under that policy. And finally, some states had different definitions of what a keg is, and so we wanted to make sure that a keg goes all the way down to an 8-gallon. If a keg is only a 31-gallon barrel, if that's how they define a keg, then you could still get a whole bunch of beer and not have to worry. So those were the three core components that we thought were most relevant. And then once we applied that, we came up with three distinctions in that middle part. One, threshold. They have all three of those core components. They have a Kegrang policy, and they have all three of those core components, and there were 19 states in that one. And then we decided to go kind of sub-threshold and threshold plus. Sub-threshold, they have a Kegrang policy, but they don't have at least all three of those. They may have two of them, but they don't have all three of those important core components, eight states there. And then we felt like that deposit was probably important, but we felt there had to be some actual minimum amount. It couldn't be a $5 deposit, right? Because there, again, would be no incentive there. So we put the bar somewhat arbitrarily at $25, and so we felt like there were three states that not only had all three of the core components, but had this additional requirement of a deposit. Here's just a map showing those states and where they fell out. Again, this is just to illustrate to you the process that we went through to assign a strength rating to the different policies. We did this process for 19 different policies in the APIS system. And again, and I'm sure Norman can speak to this too, this is a pretty big undertaking, and we even had the advantage of having APIS sitting there. We spent a couple of years basically going through this and vetting it and working through it. So now we've went through 19 different policies for every one of the 50 states, and we've assigned them a score. Most of them were 3, 4, 5 level, low, medium, high. We saw Kegray had 5 levels, a couple just 2 level. Like internal possession, which if you're underage and you blow a positive BAC, you can be charged with internal possession. There was basically 7 states that have it and 43 that don't. And so that was just a 2-level variable. Second step, let's try to put those together into some kind of an overall score for every state. Let's give every state a score. This is where it gets complicated. And this is where we decided to go slightly different than some of our colleagues and not try to just add them up, right? So I could take all these scores and just add them up. And if you were a state that had a lot of 4s and 5s, you'd get a really high score, and that'd be a more restrictive. And if you were a state that had a lot of 1s and 2s, you'd get a low score. Our concern was we could weight and look at strength within a policy, but we haven't done that weighting across policies. And now if a state has a 4 on a weak policy, and another state has a 4 on a really strong policy, they're getting counted the same. So we decided to go a slightly different path. Rather than try to come up with those weights, and I have colleagues who are doing that, so that's great, we decided, let's just look at how they might naturally cluster. So slightly different. Now all what we're really trying to say is are there clusters of states that have a similar alcohol policy profile? So it's slightly different. I think it's very complementary to the other approach, but it's a topic for conversation, and I think it's going to be something that we figure out as we go forward. So how did we do this? We had to standardize each score. So again, some were 1 to 5, some were 1 to 3. So we made sure we were all on the same standardized metric. I would love to have thrown all 19 policies into this statistical model and just turn the crank and come out with things. It doesn't work that way. Unfortunately, it can't handle that many indicators. So we had to do a little simplification. We took those 19 policies and we put them into these 4 conceptual domains: underage use, underage provision, server, and general availability. So we, you know, some have 3 or 4 policies, another has these 5 policies, and you can imagine what those are. So we now have, for every state, they've got a score for each of these 4 domains or policy dimensions. And we did latent class analysis. Latent class analysis, just a fancy statistical model where it just tries to come up with little clusters of people, like all these people. And that's what we usually use it for, is people, right? And we do this like our tobacco colleagues do this a lot, and they find that there's a whole bunch of people who are never smokers, and there's a cluster of people who are chippers, and there's a cluster of people who are triers, and there are a cluster of people who are daily smokers. That's what most people use this for. We're doing it with states around policies, but it's the same idea. We're coming up with little clusters of states based on how similar they are on these policies. And we don't need to care about that. So here's what the profiles look like. So we came up with 4 clusters of states. The top one in that kind of purple, we'll call it purple. That purple one, a 0 would be like kind of, because everything's standardized, mean 0, standard deviation 1, that would be like your average across all the different policies. So that purple group is 4 states, 8%, and they clearly have stronger, more restrictive policies around all the different ones, but more so around underage use provision and availability, and actually they're not the strongest around server policies. Now we'll go to the mirror of that, that yellow trajectory. This is 6 states, if my math is right there. Yeah, 6 states, and they're the exact opposite almost. They have strong server policies, but pretty weak policies, definitely relative to the other states, around the underage stuff. We've got what turned out to be a very convenient, in some ways, statistical convenience. The largest group is that red group, and they're basically average on everything. Across all 4 of our dimensions, the largest group, 29 states, fell into that group. And then we've got this one unique little group, 11 states, where they're average on the 3, but they're actually a little bit stronger on underage use. So four pretty distinct looking profiles, and you know, you when you do this, you try to come up with those labels. Like I said, never smoker, chipper, right? So we have to come up with those. That's not as easy for something like this. We called them weak policies except for servers. That's the yellow line. And then we called them average across all, strong underage, and strong except for servers. You can see those are those numbers that I told you. So that was part two. That took about another year, so that was a pretty quick summary. Now the fun part, is it associated with it, right? That's what we really care about. So the first thing we did was we just got adult BRFSS data for each state. And I'm going to show you right here the binge drinking. This is the weighted binge drinking rate for each of our 50 states from the 2009 BRFSS. And you can see there is kind of a gradient there. That looks kind of interesting. We start when we take what we think is probably our weakest profile. They have the highest binge drinking rate. And as we move kind of up in strength, that binge drinking rate. So that's great. We were happy to see this. As you guys know, the numbers don't always work out the way we would like them to work. But that's ecological, it's got a lot of issues, so we tried to go a little bit deeper in this. So did a whole bunch of, again, another set of fancy statistical models, multi-level regressions. We're now modeling the actual outcome. We picked three outcomes here, not just binge drink, but heavy and 30-day. We put that policy class in as the state-level predictor. We put in survey weights. We put in a bunch of covariates in the BRFSS. We put in a couple state-level covariates. So we really tried to get a little bit better handle on if there's a true association once we deal with maybe some confounding that's going on. So these estimates are not easy to interpret. They're not odds ratios. They're not differences in rates. You got to exponentiate them and take one over this, and you got to bring it. So it's complicated. So all you should really focus on is probably the direction and the significance. We used those 29 states in the middle as our reference. So when I said it was a statistical convenience, is that they were average and they were a big group, and that's what we like to use for a reference. Slightly different picture here now. Before, we saw that as you moved into stronger, the binge drinking rate went down. We actually see that even that first class, the weak class except for server policies, looks slightly better. Negative is better. Lower likelihood of binge drinking, lower likelihood of any drinking, lower likelihood of any use. We definitely see that compared to the referent, the other classes look better for any and binge, and one of them looks better for heavy use. So again, mostly in the direction we would think, and again, controlling for a lot of different stuff. Okay, that's perfect because I'm about there. Okay, summarize. What's the take-home message here? A couple of things. One, we developed this kind of policy coding protocol to try to get at the strength, which is, again, a lot of us are doing now. I think it's an important thing, and I think the system works pretty well. We did the clustering, which had never been done before, and I think it adds kind of an intriguing set of complementary data of how to think about how these things. And then finally, there is, in fact, some correlation with use, at least on this kind of initial run-through. A couple limitations. Again, the BRFSS is self-report data. It's cross-sectional. We have a small N. Even though I can do a big multi-level with all the BRFSS, it's 50 states at the end of the day. A couple of those classes have 4 and 6 states. It's ecological, and currently we don't have any validation. So as you could imagine, next steps, where are we going from here? I haven't talked at all about enforcement, and many of you in the room have heard me talk. I've talked at length about enforcement. I purposely left that out of today. We did an enforcement survey. We're working on trying to bring enforcement in and how that plays into this. Second, it's hard at the state level. You know, at the state level sometimes we'd like to drill down, particularly when we bring in enforcement. So can we get down to more of a community level? And then partly that validation component, partly the causality, all those different things, we want to be able to do this over time, bring in some longitudinal data. Thank you.